Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of vanityfair.com, and we have in our New York studio three people. We have our digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hey, Katie.
We have our chief critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And in from the coast, we have our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
I'm back from vacation. Thank you all for letting me escape. I appreciate your generosity and letting me run away for a minute. But we have a lot to talk about now that we're back in. We've got a bunch of new releases, and we're also going to start verging into talking about television as Emmy season approaches. To kick things off, we wanted to look back a little bit to last weekend. We didn't really get into Ready Player One, which was the big box office winner of the weekend. It's the new Steven Spielberg movie. It is, by all means, some level of an event, even if it isn't as huge as Spielberg's movies have been in the past. Joanna, you talked about it briefly from seeing it at South By. Richard, you managed to see it, and I think you were a fan, right?
Yeah, I liked it. I saw it as a civilian would, in that I paid for a movie ticket. I got popcorn and soda. Sat with the hoi polloi, and, you know, in one of those reclining seats. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I mean, I think that a lot of the discourse on Twitter had been so negative about it from like film Twitter people because, you know, it's nostalgia and it's like, why do we need to like have a whole movie that celebrates geek culture when everything is geek culture now? And, you know, so I understand those criticisms and I see them in the movie. But like, I thought like it has great action scenes and it's also a really interesting commentary made by Spielberg about Spielberg kind of movies like event tentpole blockbuster movies. And there's a little bit of regret in it, I think, about that he's like considering his legacy and watching people kind of take ownership of these films that he's made. And I don't know, I thought there was a psychological depth to the movie that like if you infer it was there, which I thought was cool.
If you put that on it, I agree with you and wish the movie had space to go deeper into that. Do you know what I mean? Like, if that's the case, then Mark Rylance's character Halliday is playing like the Spielberg avatar, and I wish that the film had had room. The stuff with Mark Rylance I thought was the most interesting stuff, and that's not what like the most people are there for that movie. And if they had had space to go deeper into that, I think I would have liked the movie more. But Spielberg said sort of defiantly at South by Southwest and then again at the LA premiere that this is a movie, not a film. And so
just let me say yuck.
So that to me like set it up as something where he's like, don't overthink this. But like, I would prefer to overthink it. I would prefer to have Richard's approach to it, which is like wondering what kind of commentary it's making. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think also like, I don't know. Did you see critique of like that culture in there or is it just pure celebration? Cause I couldn't really decide where to fall on that because if it's just pure celebration of a culture that like kind of did gradually lead to Gamergate and all this kind of like terrible stuff. And I think that's what was keeping a lot of people away from the movie was like, I don't need to see that celebrated. But do you think that it's critical of it at all?
I think it does not engage in some of the realities of fandom as it exists today in terms of like Gamergate or like I call them the fanboy wars over like DC movies or Star Wars movies, right? And stuff like that. Like what that kind of fandom that both Ernie Klein wrote about in the book and Spielberg helped spawn with blockbuster culture in the first place. It's changed so much. And for the film to not grapple with it makes me feel like it's not grappling with anything, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's fair.
So this movie had the biggest opening of a Spielberg movie since Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which somehow was already 10 years ago. By all indications, the next movie he's going to make is another Indiana Jones movie. Does this seem like it's any kind of turning point for Spielberg or just kind of like he's going to continue doing his own thing, going between his big movies and his, you know, the post type things? I mean, I'm just kind of curious where he goes next after this.
Well, this is a tricky one because, like, Ready Player One, I guess, in some senses is, like, yeah, like, we're back to, like, Blockbuster Spielberg. But it's also kind of this, like, technological experiment with it's a lot of mocap and stuff like that. So it doesn't feel quite the blueprint of a traditional, you know, big Spielberg movie. So I don't really know where he's going with this one. It's kind of an oddity. But yeah, it has been a while since he's had, like, a big, big movie. So that is sort of, I wonder if he almost made this to kind of prove to himself or to the world that he could still do it. And it seems to be paying off.
How does it compare to AI, artificial intelligence? Oh, is it a spiritual heir?
No, sadly, no.
So it's not Kubrickian in any way.
Are you an AI fan?
I kind of am. Yeah.
I love that movie.
And I think when I read what I read of Ready Player One, which was not a lot because I actually couldn't get through it, it felt to me like cheap Snow Crash. And this is a conversation that Joanna and I have had, and to the point where Joanna actually ended up interviewing Neal Stephenson, who wrote Snow Crash, basically based on that conversation. But maybe I should accept that maybe Ready Player One is more realistic than Snow Crash because it actually does present the gamer world in all of its sort of appalling, smells like farts and old couches and Cheetos way. I don't know. I haven't seen it and I don't really want to see it. But so I guess I'm just pontificating for no reason. But like, is it, I don't know.
Well,
tell me something.
Yeah,
more.
Let me tell you something more, which is that the thing that Snow Crash does, that Neal Stephenson book does that is so interesting, is talk about the way in which having an avatar of yourself messes with your psychology and messes with society when you can look like anything.
Right. And we're living in that world, and that was very prescient.
Yeah, and we're like rapidly approaching that, if not already there in various ways. I was talking about this elsewhere, like just even like presenting the best selfie of yourself online is part of avataring yourself.
Right.
And that is not something that Ready Player One grapples with at all, even with Lena Waithe's character, who's playing a character who's so different. Like Lena Waithe, I actually genuinely think is the best part of the movie next to Mark Rylance. But like her, this way in which her avatar is so different, you know, she is, and this is from the book too, you know, she's like, she's a black woman. I don't know if it addresses her sexuality at all. In the book, she's a lesbian. And then in the gaming world, she presents as like hyper-masculine. I mean, white-ish. She's an orc. I don't know. But like, you know, and it does not even come close to thinking about that disparity and what that means. That movie doesn't. You know what I mean?
No, it's just like a little reveal and then it's passed. The book actually does like sit down with that for a second and like thinks about like, and it doesn't really go into like why our sort of the baseline assumption is that it's like a white dude like behind the avatar. But yeah, no, I don't think that this movie is not concerned really with any sort of like higher thought or politics, you know. Or
right.
Whatever.
It wants to be fun. It wants to be a fun
and
film.
I think
it's a movie. It's a movie.
It's a movie, not a
film. It's a movie.
I'll say I cried at a point toward the end.
When did you?
In a Rylance scene.
Oh, okay.
Because he's just so
that's fair.
Good and weird. And
Spielberg and Rylance, how are you not going to cry?
You know, I cried during the BFG, so I'm here with you.
I slept during the BFG. I would have cried had I been awake.
All right.
Joanna, so you wrote about Ready Player One at South By and talked about kind of the very geek-friendly vibe of its premiere. And from South By, you also wrote about A Quiet Place, which is out this week. And I was remembering us kind of kicking ourselves for last year not discussing Get Out as an early in the year horror movie that was an Oscar contender. So are we avoiding sleeping on A Quiet Place by talking about it now? Or is it a good horror movie that isn't going to be quite Get Out size?
It is definitely not going to be Get Out size. Like, no way. Because it just doesn't – I liked it. I liked it a lot. And it is similar to Get Out in that it's like, I think we talked about this elsewhere, that it's like a TV comedian turned director turning in a very like slick, I would say, horror film. And certainly the fact that John Krasinski wrote, co-wrote and directed and stars in and cast his wife as his on-screen wife and has a lot to do with the anxieties of raising children in this world, and they are raising children in this world. Like, there's certainly things he's saying about himself and his own family in there. I can see that. But he's not making a broader social commentary the way that Get Out did, and that's why I don't think it's going to penetrate quite the same way that that film did.
But it is really good.
It is really
good.
You
know, and I'm not a horror movie guy, or I'm trying to be better about that. This is one of my 2018 resolutions. because there's so much artful horror now, so it's kind of stuff that I have to see between this and Hereditary and Get Out last year. But yeah, it's a lot of jump scares. The direction is so like inventive, and like all these big set pieces. So they're basically being chased by monsters who will come eat you if you make any kind of loud noise or even moderately, you know, audible noise. So it's kind of a silent movie for a lot of the stretch, for a lot of it. And but yeah, it's fun. I mean, I watched through my fingers, but like it was, you know,
I would call a movie. A movie that I enjoyed versus a film.
We can't buy into Spielberg's language. Don't let him win this battle.
Is it a spiritual sequel to Mother?
Everything is a spiritual sequel to Mother.
It's a spiritual sequel to Mama. There are a few like new, because this isn't John Krasinski's first movie. I think it's his third, at least his second.
There was it's his third.
It's third, yeah. But there are some like, I don't know, I would call them like rookie director moves. Like there's this one part, you know, whenever you do a post-apocalyptic movie, you have to establish the rules of that movie or else people don't understand. And there's a way in which it's really effectively done in the beginning with this like silent sequence.
Yeah.
And then there's a part where a camera just pans around some like whiteboards where like rules of the world are written. And you're like, okay, that's...
I think he's literally written in all caps, creatures. Yeah. I think that's one of... It's like, okay, we
get like
it.
Creatures, they are attracted to noise. What kills them? We don't know. We need to figure it out. Like written on the whiteboard. I was like, okay. But the jump scares are good. There's a set piece with a like corn silo that I would hold up against. Yeah. Like any
that's
other
a spiritual sequel to The Dressmaker. If anyone saw that movie,
good coincidence because Best Corn Silo is a new category at the Oscars next year.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Krasinski has it all locked up. Then.
Yeah, people have been pushing the Academy to do that to make that change for a long while. It's interesting because one of the actresses in the film, Millicent Simmons, who plays one of their kids, she's deaf herself, and she was also recently in Wonderstruck, the Todd Haynes movie. And the way that her deafness factors into the story, it doesn't feel gimmicky. It feels organic to it, you know. So I think that's an interesting, you know, sort of extra value to the movie. And also Emily Blunt should be in every movie ever made. She's amazing.
She's amazing. Yeah. It's true.
I feel like I say this after every single Emily Blunt movie I see. It's like, she's amazing. Why can't she be in more stuff? I mean, I guess she's got Mary Poppins coming, which is like the truest star vehicle she's ever had. So hopefully that winds up coming true.
This made me long for the Edge of Tomorrow sequel that she allegedly had to scupper to do like Mary Poppins or something like that because is still going to do because David Fear of Rolling Stone, I ran into him on the street at South By after the movie and he's like, it goes from Alien to Aliens, The Quiet Place. I was like, it does. And she's just like, she's so very fearsome in the end of that movie and in a way that just made me want more Emily Blunt action, which is so funny because it's not at all what we thought of Emily Blunt sort of when she first came on the scene, and she can do anything. But I was like, but also Emily Blunt action, please.
Yeah.
Sicario, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Like good revelatory. Yeah. Amazing.
I still think about her arms in Edge of Tomorrow, like all the time. Every time I get near a weight, I think about that.
You could have those pythons, Katie, if you just try.
God, just never really wanted them. Just one other question to link it to Get Out, which I think we've all agreed like isn't the best comparison, but it does feel like after Get Out and the way that it launched Jordan Peele's career, that horror is becoming this vehicle for not just actors, but a lot of people to kind of prove what they can do. So it does feel to me like regardless of how A Quiet Place does at the box office or, you know, the Oscar attention it may or may not get, it does feel like it's going to launch John Krasinski in an interesting way and makes him an interesting filmmaker to watch, which I don't think many people would have necessarily assumed based on his other two films.
Well, yeah, I haven't seen Conversations with Hideous Men, but I have seen The Hollers.
Me
and
too.
Oh boy, that is like classic Sundance stinker, you know, quirky family, homecoming kind of thing. And so then to have his third film be this like really, I mean, whiteboards with creatures written on it aside, this really like accomplished, confident, you know, film. Like, I think it's exciting, and I think it's going to kind of rebrand him almost as kind of like a thriller director, which I think he could do interesting things in. And he's going to be Jack Ryan on Amazon soon, so he's, yeah.
But if you want to make a movie as opposed to a
film.
Streaming television show, in other words, if you want to make a movie people actually go to and you don't have $100 million, like, horror is probably your best bet these days, right? Because people actually will go for the fun of sitting in a theater while everybody screams. Right.
And people want horror to be something new. They don't expect it to be intellectual property they're already familiar with, unlike basically every other movie.
Yes. And it doesn't really cost that much. It's just about it's just about shooting it well and having a great script and some creepy stuff that
really
isn't that expensive.
The creatures look pretty good in this movie, actually. They're done by ILM. So there is some good CG in the movie. But for the most part, you're right. Like, the whole point is you don't show the creature. So for the most part, you're just like wandering around a farmhouse, you know, like reacting to noises or whatever.
Yeah. And that's not that expensive. Right. And you just have to have a good editor, a good score. You know, And I also think that the lower cost of horror movies is sort of integral to it because it forces you to be more inventive, I think, and like kind of like, it's how you don't show something. I think that like if Krasinski wants to make four more horror movies after this, I think he'll, you know, they'll give it to him because I think the movie will do well and I'll be eager to see them.
And Emily Blunt should be in all of them. The end.
Yeah.
And then they can hang out as a family while they film.
Right.
It is kind of living the dream. So spring isn't just the time for horror movies and blockbusters. It's also kind of a weird spot for movies that kind of on paper seemed like they could be really awardsy and might be fall releases and then kind of mysteriously come into theaters in the spring, which is the case with Chappaquiddick, which Mike, you and I were on the red carpet for it at Toronto last year. We talked to the stars and saw it. It's out this week. It's got Jason Clarke playing Ted Kennedy and kind of the story of what happened at Chappaquiddick that kind of briefly derailed his political career, although he continued to have one for a long time. And it's funny because the consensus around this movie, and I think in Toronto too, was that it was pretty good. So do any of us have a good working theory on why it's coming out now in the spot where it can be respected but not necessarily an awards thing?
I really don't know. And, you know, it reminds me of last year, The Lost City of Z, which got pretty good reviews out of the New York Film Festival the previous
fall. It
was a
centerpiece at the New York Film Festival.
Yeah.
It had a big splashy debut.
And then Amazon just dumped it in April. That movie didn't get nominated for anything, and it really deserved it because it's a great movie. I don't think that Chappaquiddick is as good as Lost City of Z, certainly, but it's interesting, and it's really well acted. I think Jason Clarke, I mean, you know, in a quiet, let's say it's a quiet Best Actor year, like, he would definitely be a contender if the movie didn't come out in April, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting because Byron Allen, remember, bought this movie for like $20 million out of Toronto and really kind of made a splash by doing that. We assigned a piece about him that Rebecca Keegan wrote for our site. And I mean, I'm not saying that it's not true, but I like that he's trying to do a little kind of guerrilla marketing by telling people that powerful people tried to get him to stop, not let him release the movie. And it probably is true because the Kennedys.
That's a Harvey Weinstein tactic.
That
right
the
there.
Movie,
it's a
the
little
Kennedys.
Harvey-ish. I think Byron Allen has some Harvey-ish only in the publicity side of things, for all I know, instincts. But anyway. But maybe he thought that this could be his chance to kind of stand out from the crowd.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, at a time when a lot of people just finished watching The Crown a month or two ago, maybe it felt like something else that would fit in pre-midterms. I don't know. It does seem like it would have been better later. Closer to midterms, closer to a lot of other stuff. It's a strange decision.
Yeah, we're in a political year. You know, I mean, everything's political now, but like,
right.
And I was looking at the calendar. I mean, I wasn't on the episode where we predicted for the Oscars next year, but like, it's kind of a soft year right now. There'll be like a Lady Bird will emerge, you know, out of the blue. But like, yeah, I feel like it could have fit in there somewhere in the fall.
I guess on the other hand, if it was in last year's Toronto, what were they going to do? Release it in December? I mean,
right.
You know, they weren't going to be able to use Toronto for it. Yeah, I don't know. I guess it's a funny thing. Maybe the Kennedys paid him $50 million to release it now.
So it would be buried.
Bury it in April. Here's $50,000 to release it in April.
Okay, the only reason I wanted us to talk about Chappaquiddick was that some Mike could do his impression.
So should we tell people to go see Chappaquiddick?
The movies the Kennedys don't want you to see, yes.
Oh, I liked it. I thought it was good. It's a little slow, but I mean, the story is just bananas. I don't think people really understand this story.
Yeah, and I think it plays well with the moral struggle of it, you know? Like, he's not entirely a villain, but he's certainly not a good guy. And trying to grapple with what we knew Ted Kennedy to become in the Senate, like, he really was a valuable, you know, hardworking, like, you know, supporter of progressive, you know, Democratic politics, and yet this did this terrible thing, like, kind of toward the start of his career. So I think the movie is good about not letting him off the hook and not letting us off the hook, you know?
Yeah, it's not the most sort of aggressively conspiratorial, nightmarish version of events. It's like a fairly down the middle, like, Teddy was kind of a hot mess who drank too much and was definitely in a situation he shouldn't have been in, but like, not a murderer.
Yeah.
But where it comes down, spoiler alert, I'm telling you spoiler alert right now.
For the history of Chappaquiddick?
Just that, no, because what the movie sort of lands on is this kind of Godfather-ish, like, you know what, I'm actually not going to apologize. I'm going to move forward and embrace my destiny. And that's what's interesting about the film as a kind of a moral thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's I know that there was a joke around the marketing of it earlier this or last month, because I think they said something like based on a true story or this actually happened or something like that. And a bunch of people, like older, not that old, but like older people were like, it's so sad that like there is probably a whole generation of people who've never heard the word Chappaquiddick, don't know like what this scandal is at all. And so they should see it. for yeah. the information.
Chappaquiddick was definitely the part of my U.S. history class where we were kind of running out of room in the rest of the year, and we really like scanned past it quickly. So, I mean, I'm older than a lot of the people who'd remember it.
That's because of liberal education.
Because the Kennedys paid her teachers $50 million.
Paid my South Carolina public school teachers to keep it from me.
By the way, this would have been like a Tuesday afternoon scandal in the Trump administration.
Yeah.
They were like, Chappaquiddick, when was that? Last week? I can't remember.
I don't know. We're on to the porn star now.
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah, I was thinking about that watching the movie, like about what would happen if like a Democratic senator now like rolled his car into a pond, and you know, like I feel like I don't know what would happen.
I shouldn't minimize because it is quite intense, but like it's less shocking than some stuff that happens these days.
Well, it's actually really interesting, Mike. You and I saw it at Toronto, which was like just a couple weeks before the first Harvey Weinstein story broke, and you know, ushered in the Me Too movement. And it makes me wonder what it would be like seeing it now, where you've got these women who were integral to the campaign and were called the Boiler Room Girls, and Mary Jo Kopechne, who was killed in the car accident, is played by Kate Mara, was one of them. And the movie kind of tries to do its best to lift them up into their proper historical place, but it does feel like watching it now, thinking about women in the workplace, it might still feel a little behind the time somehow, even though it was made last year.
That's a good point. And also, I mean, it does gloss the Me Too aspect of the whole thing, where again, spoiler alert, like he should not be drinking and hanging out in his car at 2 a.m. with like a female aide, but he's not chasing her around the table like he perfectly well might have been doing in actual reality. Like this is still a sort of noble version of like Ted Kennedy, right. You know, liberal hero who made a horrendous mistake.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I do think that the alt-right version, Cuckaquiddick, will be very interesting.
As I threatened to you off air, I definitely have to just say, just so it was worth it, that I saw the film Breathe on the airplane out here.
Speaking of Toronto movies, yeah.
With Andrew Garfield and Claire Foy, and directed by Andy Serkis. And that is, like, if I've ever seen one, a straight down the middle, like, in another time, a straight down the middle, give me an Oscar for this movie.
Oh,
right?
Fully, yeah.
And, like, it just goes to what we were talking about all through the Oscar season, which is just, like, this Academy is not interested in that anymore. I mean, it was capably directed. Andrew Garfield did, I thought, a great job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Claire Foy, great in everything that she does. And it was just like nobody talked about it.
Yeah. I was watching Unsane with Claire Foy last week or 2 weeks ago. And I was like, oh, this is so fun seeing her in a movie. And then I was like, Richard, you have seen her in a movie. It was called Breathe. You went to the premiere in Toronto. Like, I had completely forgotten about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, if it had come out 20 years ago,
yeah.
It would have been a much different story. I
exactly.
Think.
Yeah. Eddie Redmayne has an Oscar for doing something very similar. So, you know.
Yeah, but everyone knows who Stephen Hawking is. This guy was less, you know,
true.
Famous,
glamorous.
I guess.
Glamorous.
Garfield needs to start traveling with that school bus full of children again, I think. That would really help his chances of getting
once
noticed.
Once he lost those kids.
Yeah.
I hope those kids all get to see Angels in America. Like, he's just helping them see that one next.
Right?
They're probably old enough now.
I'm sure.
Yeah, that's true.
Understand the themes.
Andrew Garfield and Jake Gyllenhaal are my two, like, I need them to have Oscars and quite soon people.
Well, Stronger was another movie
I
about
know.
A man facing a disability that was at Toronto that also, I think more people talked about that than Breathe, but it also just like fell off the map.
Yeah, that had Toronto buzz, but like on the flip side, and I said this before, all these South By movies, these like big headliners that South By booked this year are like, you know, between A Quiet Place, Ready Player One, and Blockers. Like, they did a good job programming their headliners this year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not always the case. Sometimes they program headliners that don't go anywhere. But this year was like a really, really good year for them. So
and they've screened. I mean, Get Out, Boyhood. They didn't premiere those movies, but they have screened them, and those are movies that won Oscars. So like, I feel like whereas South By's focus is more on the sort of, you know, commercial
movies not films,
like maybe that will shift a little bit, you know, the more the festival kind of becomes a serious film festival.
So wait, going back to all the movies we've discussed, do any of them have any chance of any Oscar nominations? I feel like Jason Clarke probably not.
I mean,
from April, it's gonna be too busy.
It'll be busy now, but I mean Ready Player One does have some pretty spectacular special effects. There is a sequence involving a beloved horror movie, I won't spoil anything, that is really well done. I mean, I just kind of ingenious the way that they blend sort of practical things and special effects and computer stuff together. So I think that could be in the mix, but, you know, it depends on, I think, how well it does.
Yeah, and I would say similarly for A Quiet Place, like if A Quiet Place did really, really well, I could see some of those ILM practical effects or digital effects getting in there, maybe.
Or sound editing.
Yeah, ooh.
Yeah.
Sound editing for A Quiet Place,
yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Der.
Yeah. Joanna, you mentioned blockers briefly, and I feel like we should point anyone who didn't hear the South by Southwest episode we did a few weeks ago. We kind of talked about that in some detail that you saw it there and loved it. It's also out this week. I'm guessing also not something we're going to peg for Oscar contention, but definitely something people should see, right?
Well, did they introduce the butt-chugging category this year? If so, along with Best Porn
Silo.
No, I don't think so. No, but it's really fun. Richard, you were not as...
No, I really liked it. Okay. I didn't love some of the John Cena stuff. I didn't like some of the crasser kind of sex jokes because I think they were like not as elevated and sort of forward thinking as a lot of the other humor and characterization was. I thought that I think it was kind of thrown in like for the boys in this way that I was obnoxious. But like Leslie Mann is fantastic. Ike Barinholtz really clicked for me in that. And the kids, the girls, I don't know their names. I'm sorry, but they're so great.
One of them is Gideon Adlin. Pamela Adlin's daughter. She is great.
Right.
And
yeah.
Susan Sarandon's son is in that movie too. I actually think it's the reverse. That film was actually originally called, I talked to Kay Cannon about this, the director, and that film was originally called Cherries. It was about three dads, and it was written by dudes, and then rewritten by dudes, and rewritten by dudes, and then Kay Cannon got it, and like, she doesn't have an official screenwriting credit on it, but she kind of told me that she rewrote most of it. And
right.
So all of that stuff that you're objecting to, the gross out humor, I think that's left over from this original thing she got. And she put in all the like really emotional.
Oh, so I got like, it wrong.
Yeah, the reverse of that. She like hid, I think, a really progressive and interesting and emotional film inside a gross out fratty comedy.
And it's not, there's only a couple gross outy things.
But I know exactly what you're talking about, and it is gross.
This kind of reminds me of the conversation that was on Bridesmaids when it came out, which also premiered at South By, and there was the whole bathroom scene that a lot of people were really divided on, and I feel like eventually became kind of accepted as part of the movie. But I wonder if this is just always going to be the template for female comedies, that there's going to be just like something a little gross that no one can quite decide if they
there's
like or not.
There's the girls trip moment that's like gross.
I don't mind the gross out stuff. It's more that like it needs to fit in the broader texture of the movie. And I think that in Bridesmaids, that scene works because that whole movie is a kind of like antic and up. Yeah. Whereas in Blockers, it's operating on a kind of like mellower register for most of the movie. And then all of a sudden this kind of like, thing happens. So, I think if it's just a little bit better considered, I don't mind. And I don't mind, you know, comedies about like fratty boy. Like, I love Superbad or whatever, but like, it just has to be done right, I think.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Mike, you brought up Girls Trip, which is a great segue into the last thing we want to talk about, which is the last OG, jumping over to television. It's the TBS series with Tracy Morgan that premiered this week, and it also co-stars Tiffany Haddish, which I think is the first thing she's done since Girls Trip, right?
Yeah, you know, other than like wonderful talk show appearances.
And like, showing up at award shows. And
I saw her do a panel for it at TCA last August, so like right after Girls Trip. Girls Trip was July, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So she was like right, like cresting or whatever.
Yeah.
And like, I felt kind of bad because the panel, like, Tracy Morgan was on the panel and no one had questions for him. They just wanted to talk to Tiffany. And even then she didn't really like, I think, know what was happening to her, but it was beginning to happen to her. I mean, she was cast on that show obviously before all of this stuff.
Right.
So it's not like her follow-up project. It's like her project that she already did that has just finally come out.
I think she was cast off Carmichael's show.
Yeah. Which is so good.
But yeah, I was a little bit unsure what to think about it. I mean, it's co-created by Jordan Peele, so like, yay for that. You know, and Tracy Morgan is great, always funny, but like, I wasn't really sure what a show with him at the center was going to look like. For some reason, I thought it was going to be multicam. But anyway, I watched it. I watched the 6 episodes they sent, and I think it's really great. I think it's like funny and heartwarming. And Tracy Morgan is a really good actor when he gets to kind of just like center himself and like be more natural and kind of more human. And Tiffany Haddish is great, and Cedric the Entertainer is great. It looks beautiful. It's like all shot in like Bed-Stuy and Brooklyn, and I don't know. I was really
that's
happy.
A lot of electrifying talent. I mean, Tracy's been through a lot. I'm so happy that he's like back in action.
Yeah.
And he was always like one of my favorite, even when he was on SNL. It's like, you know, Brian Fellows. That's just like
Safari Planet.
That's exciting to just to get the two of them. I also want Tiffany to do like a whole film adaptation of the Beyonce biting thing.
Oh God. Yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean? That should be like a 6-part Netflix docuseries or something.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, Richard, the surprise you were talking about, I think, shows up in the very beginning of the pilot, which is all that I've watched. It's, you know, available on the FX app, where it kind of starts off in this very, like, you know, quiet domestic scene where he's cooking food and they're watching the original American Idol finale. And it's this nice scene between him and Tiffany Haddish. And you get this growing sense of dread because it's showing how he got busted by the cops and sent to jail for 15 years. And then it kind of veers right into a very topical Brooklyn comedy where he comes back and he's in Gowanus and sees like all the hipsters with their strollers who were in his old neighborhood. I thought the tones balanced really nicely. And you kind of get Tiffany Haddish back again where she's got this kind of high flying job and she's kind of code switching, where she's talking to her very fancy white donors and then Tracy Morgan. There's a lot going on. Like, all pilots are kind of busy, but everything that it was dropping in there felt really promising, like it was going to go a lot of different places.
Yeah, and I think another nice thing about, you know, we've seen comedy about sort of like poking fun at like white Brooklyn gentrification as it should be made fun of. But and some of that comedy leans a little too heavy on obvious jokes, but I think that this one does it more subtly. And as the season goes on, Tracy's character called Trey, like he rejects it, but also like kind of finds a way to fold it into like his understanding of the world and his life, which like I think is an interesting sort of approach that he's not constantly resisting it at all at every point, and you know the show isn't constantly hammering away at it. So as a sort of societal issue that, you know, is very difficult to kind of talk about and unpack, I think this show with its very light hand does a good job.
You pretty much never see it from the perspective of the people who used to live or do live in the housing projects that are across the street from hipster restaurants called Kelsey's Regret. Like, that's a very real thing that's happening. And you usually see it from like self-flagellating white people, not the people who were there first.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So I like that. And, Haddish gets to have some dramatic moments, as does Morgan. There's one episode in particular that's just, it's like moving, in fact, a speech that Tracy Morgan gives. So, yeah, I think everyone should watch it. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say a show that, you know, is premiering in early April. You know, it's certainly premiering before the Emmy cutoff, but I wonder if it'll have time to get momentum.
I think TBS is not usually a place that we think of for Emmy stuff, though they got a nomination for Sam B last year.
Yeah.
So maybe this could be the beginning of TBS as a platform for Emmy consideration where it hasn't quite really been that before.
I mean, if the Oscars were desperate to get Tiffany Haddish involved any way possible, like, won't the Emmys be
should be
even twice as
I would
much?
Think so.
Right?
Yeah. And on the TBS front, like, I would hope that if The Last OG gets the praise and sort of awards the attention I hope it gets, hopefully some of that light would also shine on Search Party, which is a great, weird kind of another Brooklyn-y comedy show from a very different perspective, from the gentrifier's perspective, essentially. But that's really dark and interesting and kind of a thriller as well as being a comedy. So yeah, TBS is putting out good stuff. I just hope people pay attention.
That does it for this week's Little Gold Men. Thanks as always for listening. Please find us on Apple Podcasts and you can leave us a rating and review. We really appreciate it. We're all at vanityfair.com every day. You can find us on Twitter at Little Gold Men, and we're on Twitter on our own. I'm at Katie Rich. Mike?
Mike_Hogan.
And Richard?
Rylaws.
And Joanna?
Joe wrote this.
This episode was edited and produced by Danielle Roth.
And this year's award for the best overdue capsule review of Seth MacFarlane's Oscar hosting gig goes to newly installed chief critic, Richard Lawson.
I don't mind, you know, comedies about like fratty boys. Like, I love Superbad or whatever.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.